The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
This week on The Cyber Show, Air closes a deal. Augutera has fun with its workers. Kevin institutes financial frauds. Extortionists know what you did this Christmas. Hank redraws the legal lines. Sean gets local. And Ira rips off the big banks, all on today's Cyber Show. So, here we go.
So I got an email, and it didn't go to my spam box, and it said, "You're not going to believe this." So I didn't.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. Our next Angel to Exit members forum is January 10th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co, that's the letter A, the number 2, letter E, dot C-O, to sign up. Our next all.net members forum is Wednesday, the 11th of January. Sign up to the mailing list at all.net, that's A-L-L.net. We hope you'll enjoy the holidays, drive carefully, and tune in next week.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. Today, Russia expelled Putin to The Hague. China abandoned North Korea and adopted capitalism over communism. Iran chose democracy. And the U.S. convicted Trump of all charges. Oh, wait. That was next year. I'd say we broke the news today on The Cyber Show.
Now on to our first presenting company. Okay, Steve from AIR. So we've gotten up to the point where you're providing at least five, maybe six or seven, you know, I don't know from last time, services, you know, that are better than the other guys, right? So sort of the ultimate combo here is better, faster, cheaper. So are you hitting better, faster, cheaper? Or are you charging more? What does it normally cost a real estate agent to have access to the things that you provide?
Oh my gosh. The realtors use an assortment of technologies. And that's one of the problems. It's a mashup. You know, they've got to use the Zillow special agent and, you know, they're paying over thousands of dollars for their...
I'm sorry, what is a Zillow special agent? Well, it's like the FBI.
No, I forget. It's their... premium agent, and they get top of the list and that kind of thing.
So it's just an advertising thing to get. So when people are searching Zillow, they find you as the realtor.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you said thousands of dollars. A month.
Absolutely.
What are they buying?
They're buying that premium placement and they're gathering up lead generation clients. But
right, so that's sales and marketing. That's just marketing. But what else? Are they paying for services or what?
Oh, absolutely. They pay for their MLS system. And of course, we're not going to take that away. But there's so many other pieces of technology that they buy, the contact management software, scheduling, all kinds of different pieces.
All right. So what's happened here is there's a bunch of different applications that they're using, and each one says, I like this and that. So they're what they think is best of breed from a bunch of different applications, and you're providing a single unified application that handles it all. And it may not be as good as everything everywhere, but on the other hand, it's much more convenient and less expensive, right?
Yes, Fred, one more thing. You said faster, cheaper, better, and all that, but ours also is simple and reliable. And that's what's really key to our market, is it has to be simple to use and it has to be reliable if you're going to go out and use it in the field.
Is that because real estate agents aren't the sharpest technology?
Well, I didn't listen,
or what?
You said that. I didn't say that.
I was asking a question. I can ask a question.
I get it. Well, they say 20% of the people do 80% of the work, you know, so there's brilliant realtors out there and there's some that are just part-time hanging on.
In any case, regardless of who you are, I guess if you're smart, you have good tools, it's helpful. And if you're just doing this part-time, good tools are still helpful, right?
Yeah, sure.
So there you go. The cost of the current products people are using are thousands of dollars a month. And I'm pretty sure the subscription here is less than $100 a month. So this could be a factor of 10 reduction in cost for the realtor to do their job, or at least for that part of the support services.
Well, if you can succeed as being the single interface, You know, let's use the cartoon example, Amazon, right? You know, why do I buy things on Amazon? Because it's just easy. It's not about price. If it was dramatically more expensive, sure, I'd go through the hassle and registering on somebody's website and getting, you know, filling in the bloody forms again. But take little steps out of things for lots and lots of people, and we'll tend to gravitate to them. That's a grandiose and lofty goal for a little startup, but I think that's been the pattern to date. Whether it is a single company, a single, well, look at social media, Mastodon, you know, this distributed social media network. You know, isn't there for something this large? You know, for shopping, you know, does it need to be one Amazon on earth, or could it be a distributed marketplace where it's just as easy to buy things from other, sure, maybe similarly large, you know, but not monolithic organization. But something's got to replace the hunt and pack.
Efficiency combined with cost savings is substantial. And that's not a trivial amount, you know, saving $1,000 a month. It's not like you or I would be throwing out $1,000 a month if we could save it.
No one saying would, you know, that's, you know, and particularly people with a lot of money definitely are not throwing it out, you know, because 12 grand a year adds up.
It does, but even if it doesn't add up to that much, just being able to take your spouse or a significant other out to dinner that many more times a month makes your life better. The other thing that I find sort of impressive is I think there's intellectual property surrounding these things. And if you don't secure these sorts of things with patents, that's when you're going to get eaten by this competition. And if you do secure it with patents, you may still get eaten by the competition. At least you'll have some way to monetize your time and effort and all the things you put into it.
Yep. You know, locking down your value while you still have it. The majority of creative people, and probably the majority of people who go to the point of being entrepreneurs, you know, are not the ones who end up with the value. You were right. That value later on, you could have bought in Manhattan, you know, real estate in the day and sold it today. That would have worked, but you didn't. So nail it down.
Right. This is the place where engineers typically go out and get intellectual property, but can't run the business. And business people who don't have that full spectrum or who don't have the money or believe they have the money up front to do the intellectual property protection end up with a successful business then collapses because they don't have the ability to stave off competition or at least benefit from their efforts.
Value. Now, is that intellectual property? Is that pre-closed for life? I don't know. The value you provide and the compensation you want to get from it. If you think about this correctly, hopefully you should have a better than average chance of surviving those sorts of changes. You know, particularly if you're young and you're looking forward to, you know, half a century of career, you know, maybe the model changes along the way. But if you establish your value in ways that you're comfortable with, that you think you can monetize or leverage, maybe it's not money you're after, maybe it's a career, maybe it's a lifestyle, but recognize the value and then establish it. You know, get clarity. You know, who are you? What do you want? How do you get there? Where are you right now? But, you know, just don't, the only wrong is, you know, looking back and saying, ah, I should have known that.
And now a word from our sponsor. Our next Angel to Exit members forum is January 10th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, .co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. Well, now, on to our next company. Yes, from Agatero. Welcome back. So last time we were talking about ecological effects of the company and corporate decision associated with that and the data lake, all sorts of net positive for the company. There's another net positive that I think of when you talk about your view towards workers. So let's talk about the fundamental decisions that Agatero has made about workers and the environment they're going to live in.
Well, you know, so one of our founding principles is that it's going to be enjoyable. It's going to be a fun workspace. And I like taking this as one of our stakes because, as we all know, this is done well and poorly in the industry right now. The great author Terry Pratchett has a great line that the company didn't appreciate its employees so much that it had an employee appreciation day, right? So this is something I don't think you can
appreciate your employees every day,
right?
Not just one day a year.
Yeah, you can't fake this. You actually have to believe it. And I know I do. And I know you do. I think it has monetary value. I think you can have better customer employee retention, better customer relationships, shorter sales cycles if it is fun. And you execute on that. Yeah, that's right.
Fun for everybody. But just because it's fun doesn't mean you're not doing the work, right?
Right. If you're not having fun, you can't be as productive. And you can't have fun if you're faking it. You have to have the actual stuff. You have to be able to deliver the product. You have to be able to, you know, do your thing, or you can't feel good about it. In fact, it's necessary.
When we talk about having fun, so, you know, one of the things when I go on vacation, people ask, you know, what would you like to do? I go visit various countries, get asked in as a guest speaker or whatever. And they say, well, what would you like to do when you're here? And when I was invited to China and they asked me this, one of the times I said, what I'd really like to do, see the infrastructure. I want to see how the wastewater is treated in Beijing, you know. And like the response to that was like, what are you, nuts? Are you some sort of a sick person? No, that's what I like. It is fun to me to see how stuff works.
works. That's joyful to me. So my fun is different than your fun. And part of the problem in most work is that people aren't doing the thing they really want to do. They're doing all this other stuff. And it's not that there's going to be nothing that you don't want to do. There certainly has to be some things you don't really want to do that aren't going to be as fun. But as a philosophy for a company, how do you actually do this? How do you make it so that when somebody doesn't like what they're doing, they don't have to do that part and still you get it done?
Mindfulness, I think, is you know, the key of the day. You look at the failure states. You know, there's so many cliches that, you know, just watch, not even just modern movies. You go back to the 80s and watch this. You know, the boss who says, my door is always open. There's no fear talking to me. It's like, well, be realistic. As a founder and CEO, I have to recognize that I have people's careers and fates in my hand. It's like being a parent. You should be good friends with your children, but you're not the same as their friends. So recognizing the realities of it and doing the best you can. You know, how do we work through this as a group to recognize when things aren't working, to do the best you can to make them work?
So we're trying to avoid being the Stepford Wives, right?
Yes. We all know the failure states. We've seen them a million times before, right?
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. I want to get to, you started at some point to train law enforcement on forensics and these related things. When did that happen?
Oh, again, I'm trying to recall a year. I started at Fletcher, I think it was 1989. So it would have been real early 90s, probably 92, 93. And there was a component within FLETSI called the Financial Fraud Institute. And they were teaching some very basic rudimentary skill sets dealing with investigating computers. There was also another group nationally that had been formed called the FCIC, the Federal Computer Investigative Committee. And I met a number of very good, became longtime friends with them. Some of them no longer with us, like Howard Schmidt, who was head of security at Microsoft. But when I found out that they were doing that, and I said, you know, I have an interest in this. I have an interest in teaching both legal and how to obey the law, but not only obey it just in the physical world, but how to obey the law when you're conducting investigations, either online or investigations on a piece of hardware. So I managed to make some good friends in the computer crime unit of the Department of Justice, headed by them by Scott Charney. Scott is now senior vice president at Microsoft for trustworthy computing. And I was invited, a member of a group of about 50 of us, to develop guidelines for conducting investigations online.
Now, were you in the New York Electronic Crimes Task Force at that point in time as well?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that, Fred, because one of my big heroes of all time is the head who started that unit.
So yes, there was a bunch of stuff going on here. So you started training cyber cops in how to do forensic investigations, right? And what was the name of that function at FLETSI?
Well, there were some programs that I started. One was called the Internet Investigations Training Program. The other was, four programs that I started that focused on different aspects. The one that I recall you were helped us teach was investigating intrusions. We had our own little network in our classroom, and we also had it through the students. And I call it the CyberCop Network. I recall you renamed it. You called it the PsychoNet.
Well, yeah, that's because when you spend enough time with CyberCops, you go a little bit crazy. So you're also in the Electronic Crimes Task Force, the New York Electronic Crimes Task Force, which ended up being the Electronic Crimes Task Force across the whole country. It was replicated across the whole country. So that's a major component of what you were involved in. You were training law enforcement in this stuff.
I was one of many doing that at that time. But I just have to mention one name, one of my real mentors and heroes, Bob Weaver. Bob was the head of that group in World Trade Center Building Number 7. And I went and met him in Building Number 7 before it was the third building to collapse in 911. It collapsed from 14 stories down to about 7, or 40 stories down to about 7. Bob Weaver.
A lot of good friends died there on that day because, you know, that's where the cyber cops were. So
they were able to evacuate the members of the Secret Service Electronic Crimes Task Force from their offices in Building Number 7, but there were certainly thousands that died, and certainly among those, I'm certain there were more than a few cyber cops. I'm thinking about Charlie O'Neill, and he's the one that kind of warmed. There's a great story about Charlie O'Neill.
Now you're starting to hit on all sorts of interesting things. That thing that he talked about where they developed the standards for doing forensics, so I ended up being one of the co-authors of that process. And that's when I was, I guess, working at Sandia National Laboratories, and I was doing forensics work there, providing that to cyber cops. And then the electronic crimes task, you know, I ended up in the San Francisco version of it, working with Donna Miller, who we'll interview, you know, in a later segment. So this is just connection after connection. Bob Weaver started the New York Electronic Crimes Task Force and built it into the national thing that it became, which is the only national capability we have for dealing with electronic crimes across different agencies run by the U.S. Secret Service. So the extent to which this affected my life and career, I also, as he mentioned, taught at FLETC in a couple of his courses. And it's sort of astonishing just this set of effects in this few minutes that he described.
You know, Sean McGurk created the National Cybersecurity Communications Integration Center, the NCIC. If I asked Sean, I would bet that what Kevin did, you know, influenced and led to that. Everything's connected. You know, why shouldn't we have some center where all these things are being processed at this point? And the NCIC now is an organ of the federal intelligence and criminal system.
Yeah, well, the CyberCops portal was a precursor to that.
Exactly.
Remember, after 9/11 is when they reformed and created Homeland Security out of all these agencies. Before that, Kevin was teaching people at all these agencies, and he created this bulletin board system that was the only fusion place that they had for all those agencies. And this is, you know, running on his 386 computer on a bulletin board system, you know, basically at FLETC, so it wasn't out of his house. So the precursor to our national capability was Kevin throwing something up and getting it done despite people trying to stop him from doing it.
Well, and then there's so many lessons. You know, as we discussed last time, I think there's amazing opportunities in cyber and cybersecurity left. Right. You know, because I see the same things happening over and over again. And a lot of it has to do with what you're talking about here. Right. If you understand that it's taken 10 years or 15 years to get where we are right now that we complain about
30, 40, 50.
And, you know, then you can say, all right, you know, so supply chain, you know, the supply chain issue surprised me in late 2018. I was moderating a panel in London and someone said there is no supply chain security whatsoever, none. And it just sort of dawned on me at that point. And over the next, you know, 6 months and year and so forth, you know, sort of ramped into what I'm involved with now. But it's like, obviously we're going to, haven't done it at all, you know, and
it's not like we haven't done it at all. It's that we've done it poorly.
Right. I was about to say, you know, to the lessons, you know, folks like Kevin share with us. We've done parts of it. You look around, there are pieces. You know, Alan Friedman, then at the Department of Commerce, you know, takes that structure of the NTIA, the National Telecommunications Information Administration, right?
With a funny little. And there was NSTAC, right? NSTAC that was doing the coordination before that as well.
But it ends up being a group of people, right? You know, who get, you know, in the current context, you know, Alan got, you know, the presidential administration to write an executive order. And it's because of all these things we're talking about, because Howard Schmidt and Kevin and Sean McGurk and, right? You know, and it's being done the same way, right? You have to have enough behind it to move these big machines forward. And if you look around, people like Alan in the current era have done exactly that, you know.
Yeah,
leveraging the work we all this before.
Yeah, and Kevin, you know, did it for a lifetime and changed the world in a lot of ways. There's another thing when you talk about the supply chain security stuff. So at the high levels of surety, there was a lot of supply chain security in place from the Cold War. And part of the reason that happened is because, you know, they had developed their own internal supply chain for everything. So there was a change in I guess it was 1980s to early 90s, where they went from GOTS, government only, to COTS, commercial off the shelf. So government off the shelf to commercial off the shelf. And when they started adopting COTS, commercial off the shelf, they started then having this enormous supply chain that went back to everybody that made it. And then globalization created the extension of that supply chain everywhere. So by the early 1990s, you know, we were well aware of this and publishing things. And this is part of the challenge associated with computer viruses in the 1980s. So we understood that, you know, so somebody in Pakistan put something in a floppy disk, the brain virus, and it gets all over the world. So, you know, there was supply chain issues even then when people were physically carrying stuff on floppy disks that managed to get from Pakistan to the US. So it's been there for a long time. We've been aware of it for a long time. It was addressed and still is addressed in sort of high levels of surety requirements. For example, in the nuclear weapons industry, there's a lot of issues surrounding supply chain security that are very well addressed. But it doesn't come out into the rest of the society because of the cost trade-offs, right? The speed of evolution, the need, you know, I feel the need for speed, right? So the requirement to get stuff on the market faster reduces the surety, and it's a race, and it's a good race. Right? Because if we made sure of everything before we deployed it, we wouldn't have any of the good stuff we have today.
Right. You know, there's one little step. I don't think I've even shared this with you. In the 1990, you know, when I moved back to Toronto and I didn't have a real job, I was doing my first in computer consulting for Shabbat Lubavitch, a charity, and saw my first viruses. You know, looking at these little 3D6 computers they had and so forth, and they're just infected with everything. Right. So that was my contact with computer security. And as you say, a lot had been done by then. You know, I didn't, you know, get involved with any of this until a year or two later. And we're still going. Right. And it's.
Yeah. And we're going to be still going. This is not over. It's just begun.
And, you know, in a lot of the conversations, the shows I've been doing the last year and so forth, I try to stretch the timeline back 6,000 years, you know, 10. You know, let's look, you know, we've been doing these things for a long time. Yes, we have new challenges and so forth. And the cybernetics, and cybersecurity is wonderful. But Kevin Manson, you know, look.
Yeah, well, when we say we're going to get rid of passwords, you know, these existed, you know, before the Common Era. So,
right.
No, yeah. We're not. Passwords are still going to be here. Sorry. Anybody that thinks they're going away, you're wrong. Okay, I'm just sad to say, but it's the truth.
We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our next Angel to Exit Members Forum is January 10th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, .co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. This particular fraud is closely related to the movie I Know What You Did This Summer.
Hi there.
People claim to have broken into your computer accounts.
I am a professional hacker and have successfully managed to hack your operating system. Currently, I have gained full access to your account.
That they're secretly watching you.
In addition, I was secretly monitoring all your activities and watching you for several months.
Sometimes they'll give pseudo-technical explanations of how it is that they have control over your system, how they gain control, what they can do with it, and so forth.
It means that I can see absolutely everything in your screen and switch on the camera as well as microphone at any point of time without your permission. In addition, I can also access and see your confidential information as well as your emails and chat messages.
And then they'll make other claims like,
I have made a video compilation, which shows on the left side the scenes of you happily masturbating, while on the right side it demonstrates the video you were watching at that moment.
They send this out along with basically an extortion opportunity.
All I need is just to share this video to all email addresses and messenger contacts of people you are in communication with on your device or PC. Furthermore, I can also make public all your emails and chat history.
Where you can pay them, typically in Bitcoin.
I believe you would definitely want to avoid this from happening. Here is what you need to do. Transfer the Bitcoin equivalent of $850 to my Bitcoin account.
Some of them will give you pretty thorough instructions on how to do this, while others will leave it up to you.
That is rather a simple process, which you can check out online in case if you don't know how to do that. Below is my Bitcoin account information, Bitcoin wallet,
which they somehow believe is untraceable.
Once the required amount is transferred to my account, I will proceed with deleting all those videos and disappear from your life once and for all.
Of course, no extortionist, having generated $850 from you, will not bother to get more. So typically, when you give in to one extortion attempt, you'll get more of them.
Kindly ensure you complete the above-mentioned transfer within 50 hours, 2 days. I will receive a notification right after you open this email. Hence, the countdown will start.
The reason they put a time limit is that they want to force you to act without being able to take enough time to think. Generally speaking, this sort of a deadline approach comes with the threat. The notification that they're going to tell you about says that you may already have run out of time because you might not have read your email right away, so you better hurry up. Of course, this particular email doesn't have any capability to do any such thing, but that's another issue.
Trust me, I am very careful, calculative, and never make mistakes.
Now, when an extortionist tells me to trust them, you know,
really, I'm supposed to trust you that you never make mistakes because you threatened me?
If I discover that you shared this message with others, I will straight away proceed with making your private videos public.
And again, the threat. Don't contact the police. Don't tell anybody I did this. So you're alone against them, the mysterious evil, I can do anything against you. And finally, of course, in order to be, especially nasty at the end, they tell you,
good luck.
So I get probably a dozen of these a month in one form or another. This particular one was emailed from and to the same email address. It's an email address that no longer exists in my system. So it's, for me, it's a dead giveaway. But for you, it might seem very real. And of course, having sent it from the same address that it's sent to, that brings credibility that they may have broken into your accounts. It turns out if you're a little bit sophisticated about it and you look at the header information, you can determine that it wasn't in fact sent from the same address as it went to. But that level of depth almost never occurs. And, you know, like most such things, they don't really care about getting caught. You know, so whatever the thing is that you think could happen bad to them is not likely to happen. The thing to do about this is nothing. It's junk. Put it in your junk mail. Act like you never got it. Just to note, if you have been doing bad things, well, then maybe you're in trouble. But for the most part, you know, what they're accusing you of is something you might be ashamed of, but it's normal. If they're accusing you of a crime, which they sometimes do in these extortions, they claim to have this and that and the other thing, but they haven't given you the receipts to prove that it's true. These sort of blanket extortion emails are just not credible. You shouldn't believe them and you should ignore them. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by snow. When outside there's snow, folks, listen to the show.
Now, on to our next service provider. Hank, welcome back. Hank is the cyber lawyer, not a liar. Promised to tell the truth, except, of course, that he said that if he was lying about the promise, then you can't count on the truth of what he says. So, Hank, last time we were talking about intellectual property, especially for small and early stage companies. People talk about patents and trademarks and trade secrets and trade names, and there must be other kinds of intellectual property of that sort. Can you talk us through briefly what makes sense and doesn't make sense in terms of getting or not getting these things, or how much it's worth and how much time they should spend on it?
Sure. What I can say, starting out generally, to say intellectual property protection is very, very, very enterprise specific. The general baskets of intellectual property that we talk about are copyrights. It can be a written expression, which can be a composition, a musical composition. It could be a video work, pictorial work.
A game, right? Software?
Sure. You could have elements of of software that can be copyrighted. The code itself is reduced to a written medium, that expression. You could also have certain elements of software that could be patented based upon the functionality.
Can you copyright a mathematical formula?
That's a great question. I would say, off the top of my head, I don't know. I probably should. I would say probably no, because that would be the embodiment really of the idea itself. And one of the aspects of the idea of copyright is we're trying to give protection for this specific
expression.
That's right. Expression, particular medium. You're not supposed to use copyright to restrict others from exploring, using ideas. So if you're talking about a mathematical formula, it's pretty hard to separate out, I would think, the functional or the idea-based element, the sort of intellectual content from the expression itself. Maybe if you drew that formula in a beautiful way, you'd have a pictorial work there, an image that you could copyright.
Let's talk about patents then, because I can't patent a mathematical formula, right?
We talked about this previously. Patents are one area of law that we're typically, in terms of patentability, patent prosecution, filing patent applications. This is a very specialized group of folks that are, you know, sort of specifically cleared to practice before the PTO, Patent and Trademark Office. So I'll actually beg away from, you probably know better than I do, Fred, about whether or not you could patent a formula. But I would say that to the extent there are, if that formula is being leveraged in a context in which there's kind of a useful functionality that's being developed, then that may be the subject of patent.
A recipe would be an example of something you certainly could patent, right?
Well, sure. Good formula, for example, patented. One imagines that a recipe being a process for producing a thing, that could be subject to patent protection. Now, patent protection has downsides, right? You have to make it, it becomes publicly available for other people to study and learn from. Patents are sort of about advancing the inventive arts generally by requiring those folks to share some of their ideas.
So now how about, let's talk about trade secrets then, because I guess the formula for Coke was a trade secret for a long time. And there are lots of trade secrets out there. And the thing about trade secrets is you can't really register the trade secret because as soon as you share it with somebody else, it's no longer a secret, right?
No, that's right. So, I said for secret formula, but you could probably patent that process embodied in that formula, but now it's out there. Another way to try to protect is a formula for doing something is to keep it a secret, and you have to go to reasonable and sometimes more than reasonable lengths to keep something a secret with employee agreements, restricted access to information, and all these things. You know, that's, for example, right, what a Coca-Cola would do with its formula. It's looking to leverage its formula over a period of decades and not just years.
So a patent lasts 20 years, whereas a trade secret can last forever, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, how long a patent ends up sort of functionally providing protection can vary based on certain factors. But yes, a trade secret is indefinite protection if it's maintained in confidence and secrecy indefinitely.
All right, let's talk about trademarks. We've had a discussion about trademarks. As you're well aware, Management Analytics has this thing called GWIZ, which is the governance wizards or the growth wizards, and it's expressed as a capital G, capital W, lowercase iz. So you can't patent it because it's not that kind of thing. A copyright would be ridiculous on something that small, right? Because fair use says you can take an extract. You know, it's not exactly a trade secret because it's published, so it can't be a secret. So that leaves you with something like trademarks. Let's talk about trademarks and companies having trademarks. What is the value of a trademark?
To clarify, as you mentioned, I mean, you can't, things like titles of books, for example, not subject to copyright. The name of a company, not subject to copyright. Things of sort of very short length. But a trademark, something different, right? The trademarks are a way of identifying certain companies, people, as being the producers or providers of certain goods or services. The idea being, if we know, for example, that this is a Fred brand cookie, that it's going to have been baked in a certain way with a certain degree of quality, as opposed to a Hank brand cookie, which, you know, those things are awful, right? But if Hank decides to sell his awful cookies and he puts Fred's name on them, now consumers will be confused into thinking that this is a cookie that Fred baked. And what it's going to do is destroy Fred's reputation, because people will start thinking, oh, these awful cookies, which Hank actually baked, they say they have Fred's name on them. So Fred would have a trademark. You would have a trademark on your name in connection with cookies. So you could stop me from passing off my cookies as yours. And in doing that, you'd be protecting the public from getting scammed by me, Hank, the inferior baker. That's what trademarks are about. You as a producer or a provider, you develop goodwill in your mark by providing goods and services of a good quality. And consumers come to know you as a trusted provider, and they want to be able to identify the things that you produce or provide to distinguish them from others. If you develop this goodwill, as it's called, in your name or your mark, then you have something to protect there, and that's protected by a trademark law.
To me, these are the most cogent explanations with those examples of trademark that I've ever heard. And the other thing is, how much should I or should I not put into these things? You know, as a small company, I guess trademark's pretty inexpensive and not too painful to do, but you're also not that big. So there's not a big advantage to it. We're going to talk about that with Hank in the next one. But so what do you think of just the educational value that you get from this?
Yeah, I agree. I think that was well put. And I always find value in experts, you know, walking through things like that with me that I have to understand. Right. And as a security person, these are the things, right? You know, I want to be safe. I want to be secure. Okay. How safe? How secure from what?
You've talked about this in terms of, if you want to be a philosopher, security is the place to be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because it's very, very practical. Right. And this, you know, in previous discussions on the show, I've used the word value instead of intellectual property. Because what is that value? You know, it may be, you know, your network, your trusted network. Right. You know, I've got a lot of, my LinkedIn connection list is very long, and there's a lot of great people on that. And I don't have a lot of, hesitation in sharing that list of names, because the value is the fact that they know me. I know them.
So right? Now this is interesting, because you talked about this in the context of gaming in one of our earlier discussions, and you were in a game where you lost all of your assets, or the vast majority of your assets, because people attacked you within the context of the game. And the same thing is true in the legal world. And you can say it's the same kind of thing. It's a game, right? So you have your list of contacts, and somebody comes into LinkedIn or whatever and wipes them out, destroys them all for you. That doesn't destroy the relationships. That just destroys the LinkedIn connection.
Right. And where's the value? And if someone gets that list, then calls him up and says, hey, you know, Chris Blass, you know, anybody worth talking to on that list will hang up, right? It's not, they'll spend a lot of time and a lot of effort trying to contact people that won't lead to anything.
So part of this challenge associated with ownership and your good name and this goodwill thing is that in the cyber world of today, people intentionally go out to destroy your goodwill, and they can be very effective at it if you can't figure out what's going on.
Well, and again, that either ends up being a persistent state and lasts for centuries and centuries and never changes, or we come up with compensating controls to get around that. And it is, you know, we've seen this, you know, people destroyed reputational risk is enormous, right? There have to be answers to that. And we can't live in a world, you know, technical and sociological answers, you know, have to arise to improve the state over what it is now.
People try it with me historically for a long period of time. All sorts of scams people have tried for one reason or another. And there's almost always a relatively straightforward way to compensate for it, but not in the era where we have these tremendous amplifications of reputational destruction.
But I think that speaks to other, you know, structural problems we have outside of that. You know, we've created a playing field where it's easy to share information. You know, we've used that, you know, to exercise all sorts of, you know, truthful discussions and debates and so forth. But we found that, you know, nefarious actors, you know, who just have a lot of time on their hands and resource can overwhelm them, right? So, you know, again, either we stay in that state forever, or, you know, like every other aspect of information security, we evolve ways to mitigate and deal with it.
Is that going to be information security, or is that going to be the law? Because ultimately what happens is, if you can't police yourself, the police will come in and police you if enough other people in the society say they're pissed off.
Well, this is why I'm resurrecting that old phrase, information security. We're not talking cybersecurity necessarily, you know, law, policy, all of it. You know, how are we securing information?
This is one of those things where, you know, experts seem to disagree with each other about things, and people get the misimpression that we don't agree on 99.995% of it, which we do. But we're always going to argue about the 0.00 whatever percent. So what I talk about is assuring the utility of content and mechanism. And so when you say information, that's not as clear a definition, I think, as content, which is intentionally nebulous in its form, because we don't know. It can take all sorts of forms. It's still the content. And the content is this meaningful thing in the context of its utility, or in the utility of a mechanism. And that's what we're really trying to assure, is the utility that we get out of it.
Well, you know, stick to our speaker's point today, our guest's point, the you know, trademarks and IP, we talk about that sort of thing a lot, right? You know, you need to consider it. You know, if you've got a business out there, it's not worthless. And it's not a unicorn rainbow answer to all your problems. You know, think about get some good advice.
Can I get a unicorn rainbow answer to all my problems? Do you have one?
I actually do, but it only works for one thing, and it's kind of pointless, right? So,
what does it work for?
I'm trying to be, cute and come up with something really fancy right now, but I'm just going to steal from Family Guy and say it allows me to grow my fingernails slightly faster.
There you go.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Fred here. Our next Angel to Exit members forum is January 10th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co. Our next all.net members forum is Wednesday, the 11th of January. Sign up to the mailing list at all.net. That's all.net. Enjoy the holidays, drive carefully, and tune in next week. Well, now, on to our next company.
Our next presenting company is PowerGrow, building eco-fantastic high-tech greenhouses.
Sean from PowerGrow, welcome back. So, your description of what's happening in the greenhouse space, let me just ask this. Are the vegetables you grow organic, or is that determined by the grower? Or how does that work?
Well, that's really up to the grower. You can be certified organic in a hydroponic grow operation in a greenhouse. So about 5 to 10% of the population is kind of dyed-in-the-wool organic. It's either organic or it's not going in my body. 75% of the population will pay a premium for locally grown. So what we're finding is local matters more than anything else. not all organic produce is truly organic when, you know, pesticides are still being applied to a lot of organic produce. So what's important to us is that the product quality coming out of the greenhouse is optimal, whether it's certified organic or not.
So regardless of certification, is there some reason that your power grow facilities everywhere can't just be organic? I mean, is there some advantage?
The intent is that they're grown in an organic manner and that they get organic certification. But again, that's really up to the grower and who's our partner in the deal.
In the controlled environment, basically, there's nothing that's going to come in and create a problem for the plant. So you should be able to grow it just as well organic or not without any chemicals. Why do you want to pay more for the chemicals to make it not organic when it works just as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really the intent with everything we do, is it's as natural a product as possible.
Right, so healthier. Okay, it keeps going. Let's see. So now I've seen a video of your plant working, and it's really amazing. Can you just try and describe how this works and the cybernetic mechanisms behind it and how those give you advantages?
Sure. So the growing systems are designed by partners of ours, that several of whom are from Holland and Spain, who, you know, Holland, Europe and Canada are about a decade ahead of the U.S. with respect to greenhouse development, just because they had to be for geographic reasons. So the grow systems are very automated. Seeds are planted, they're germinated, propagated, and they go through the growing cycle. Everything's automated from a processing standpoint as well. So there's an automatic cutting machine, goes down a conveyor belt into a box or into a bag, and then into a box and a pallet and out the door. So produce typically that is grown one day will be shipped out the very next day. And so you end up having an environment that's almost completely automated in every respect.
So at the loading dock, you bring in dirt, maybe you don't even have to bring in dirt once you have the dirt there, right?
Yep.
And you bring in seeds, which are pretty light and small, and there's a water feed from somewhere, and that's it, right?
Yeah, the water's treated coming into the building. So we treat it with either RO, reverse osmosis, or UV.
Ultraviolet light.
Correct, yep. So the intent is to treat the water coming in so it's extremely clean and pure water that's being applied to the plant. And then the important part, the dehumidification systems in the greenhouse are really important, because one of the things that's hard to control in a greenhouse is humidity levels. And that,
so when you dehumidify that, you can use the water that you bring out of the air to feed everything as water, right? So you're saving on the water.
It becomes one big giant recirculating system that gets used over and over again. Why we say conserve so much water compared to an outdoor grow.
You bring in seeds, but what else do you bring in besides packaging material? That's it, right?
That's it.
And in fact, probably you get to where you can produce your own seeds, right? Because some of the plants grow and produce seeds. So if you produce your own seeds, once you have a crop going, you can just run that crop indefinitely.
Yeah, and again, it depends on what's being grown, right? The majority of what we'll build for is going to be leafy greens. And I'm a big fan of strawberries. So we've got a lot of focus right now on how to develop greenhouses that can maximize strawberry growth.
Okay, picking strawberries is one of those things that's in the really tough area. So do you have automation to pick the strawberries, or are you just bringing in other technologies as they develop?
Not that picks the strawberries, but the growing systems have an oscillated system that allows you to every other service walkway row, it'll rise up 8 feet. So basically we double the density and double the yield per square foot compared to the way most strawberries are grown indoors right now.
All right. But so you don't hand pick the strawberries, right?
No, they're still hand picked. And what's amazing, you know, the robotics for strawberries are interesting, but they're not quite where they need to be.
But hang on. Wait a minute. A flash in my brain. So because of the automation, you don't have to have people on the ground on their knees picking strawberries. You can run the strawberries past the people who just pick them as they pass, right?
That is key, because
the labor for
strawberries is incredibly labor intensive and hard on people.
Yeah, it's difficult to do. It's painful. And then there's just a lot of wasted time getting to and from and so forth. So now you can just sort of sit there in a chair or set up however you like to be in front of it. And just come past and just pick, right?
It's a chair that's attached to a rail system. And as they go down that row, they can pick strawberries faster than you can watch them. So they just pop, 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 pop. It's much faster than any robotic system available right now. And it's much more efficient.
Wow. I love strawberries. And I'm going to be able to get organic, wonderful strawberries year round.
That tastes like real strawberries, as opposed to, you know, every other clamshell you buy right now, you're not sure what you're tasting. And so, yeah, that's really, it's my passion project is developing a really unique strawberry mechanism.
Now, I've mentioned my maternal grandmother, Minnie Gay, born in 1907 in Mariana, Florida, in the Panhandle on a sharecropper's farm. And I picked strawberries with her when I was a kid. You know, we'd go out and pick strawberries, and she'd tell me about the strawberries her mama would grow and picking them when she was a kid. And, you know, as you guys discussed, you're bending over all day in the sun picking strawberries. It's fun to do with your grandma when you're a little kid for an afternoon. You know, when you're a little kid doing it all day long in the hot sun in Florida, it's a different world. And you just, you touched on one of my other points here, better strawberries. You know, there's so much of this dystopian futurism that says, you know, it's all going to be gray goo in the future. It's like, I don't know. I can imagine quite easily, and this company seems to be an example, where you can get better strawberries.
Yeah, so there's the whole other line here that we're not going to talk about with Sean right now, but there's a whole other line of being able to create exactly the tomato or the apple that you had when you were growing up that was the one you liked the most, right? So there's this sales process where you ship different versions of wine to people. So they get 20 different bottles of wine or 10 per month or something. They taste them, they rate each one of them. And over a couple of months, you figure out which wines they're likely to like. And then you predict the right wines to send them and they just get what they want. You can do the same thing, obviously, with food, fruit and vegetables and meat and so forth. So now you can imagine this system because you can grow different specific crops in each little area of this greenhouse, as we discussed with them before. So now I can taste the vegetables, I can say, gee, you know, this was a little bit sour. I didn't quite like this. This could be a little bit sweeter. You could probably do that. And the greenhouse at some point will be able to produce you your custom bags of strawberries or of tomatoes or of fruit, you know, or vegetable mixes, right? So I want my salad with this set of cucumbers and tomatoes and pickles and whatever else in it, and you'll get your custom lunch produced at the factory automatically. So that's a long-term future for this thing.
Well, a similar thread is lab-grown meat. And this has been a fascinating one for me because for decades, I expected to see it in my lifetime and look forward to it. But people have this visceral negative reaction. It's like, you know, no, it's going to be bad or terrible or whatnot. It's like, I don't know. I mean, we're not talking GMO. You just take a cell culture out of your, you know, favorite part of your favorite cow, and you grow that same muscle, that exact muscle in a perfect environment with the perfect amount of exercise or flavoring or fat. You know, the cow gets to not die, and I get an even better steak, right?
Well, and the other thing is it moves away from this methodology that's destroying the environment that's certainly no good for cows. I mean, if you drive along the highway in California, you go on Route 5, you know, in Central California, you drive past a huge, huge place where they do nothing but slaughter cows and grow them. And they're jammed together and they're all genetically derived from the same cow. Their life has got to be the worst sort of misery there ever was. And we're doing that right now. So there's no longer sort of the free, you know, cows and bulls out in the world evolving and populating the way they populate and live the way they live. So I think the net of this is it's probably better for the cows. You know, the other side of it is there's people that believe in not harming animals, not killing animals, whatever. So you don't have to do that with the grown stuff. And you're right, there's no need to have a, you know, GMO or anything else. And in fact, of course, you can have every different type of beef or chicken or turkey or whatever you want grown this way. Now, I'm not clear that they're at the technology point today where you're getting the same quality, the same taste, the same everything else. We're not harming the animals.
When it comes, right, there's no reason, there's no technical reason you can't grow a better steak in a tank than you can by leaving it inside a cow wandering around, you know, under the sun. And, you know, back to our guest point, this is very much the time. This person and this company, you know, has a good feeling to me. Sounds like they thought it through. They're in the right space. They've got customers for their product who already have revenue streams to support, you know, benefits that they can provide. And if it works, to our point, it changes things. If you're competing with people who are using this tech and it works, then you have higher costs and lower customer satisfaction. And suddenly you're doing it this way, which is better for all of us. Thanks.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977. Now, onto our next service provider.
Ira, welcome back. You finished the internship at the NSA, and now what happens?
So then I took what was, you know, in theory, a permanent office, which was not an intern, which, you know, could be even less time than an internship, honestly. But my job I got as a, it was more in a office that basically did large scale systems acquisitions. And frankly, it was more a paper pusher job, which wasn't exciting. The people I worked with were falling asleep at work. I once read somewhere that they described it as the CIA was more the land of Dilbert than the land of Bond. That is mostly especially true for NSA, where I was sitting there with people who were going to rot in their chair. And so that was when I decided after maybe a year of that I had to get out of there. And then I went to a government contractors and got paid 50% more to do, frankly, actually varying different things.
Yeah, but other things you were interested in, a variety of them, different things at different times, right?
Yeah. And then what happened was, so like I was doing, you know, working with NSA on some large scale system development. And I was working, then I got another job working to, I ended up putting systems inside the Pentagon. And then I started working. So those systems in the Pentagon, I ended up, you know, it was kind of the first intranet there where we were making use of things like bulletin boards, Waze, a whole bunch of other, you know, general.
Now, what year was this? Was this part of DISN or what?
That was give or take 19. Well, by that point, it was about 1994 or so where okay. I was doing
so,
that.
So you were in the, in DARPANET, right?
Yeah, I was doing, well, actually I was just working, you know, for the Office of Secretary of Defense for Policies and Procedures, I think. And, so
yeah, anyway, but the network you were talking about, that was still the ARPANET or some version of that, or well, was it DISN or what?
I think we were tying systems into the AutoDIN network at the time where they AutoDIN, were getting cables.
Sure. And AutoVON was for voice and AutoDIN was for digital, right?
Yeah. And so I was doing that. And then one day they said, instead of going, because I work for a contract, you know, government contractor, and they said, instead of going to the Pentagon, can you make a few phone calls? And 3 days later, I had control over one of the world's largest investment banks.
Oh, so, when you say control over.
Yeah, I basically social engineered them and, you know, was able to log on to their computers and do whatever I want with them. So,
right, but you weren't in management control. You were just in technical control.
In control of the computers. So
yeah, so you could do emails. You could, you know, let's tell you, you were root, right?
Well,
root.
There are more people describe it than the way I could, but I was told I was able to make multi-million dollar transactions if I so chose to.
All right. So what was the record, though, the most amount of a transaction you actually could have gotten away with but didn't do because you're honest?
Yeah, I would say over 100 million if I somewhere around there. I mean, I never tried. But, you know, when you have access to the accounts of major corporations, it was kind of interesting.
Just for, you know, because we have to do this kind of thing. My record was 40 billion.
Well, everybody needs a hobby, but
Well, but yeah. I mean, the problem is whenever we did these demonstrations for folks,
yeah,
you know, they called it red teaming or whatever you want to call it. But we would do these demonstrations and, you know, we were always like, we're not going to touch anything without your approval. When it gets to a certain point, we're not going to touch anything, whether you say so or not, because you've agreed at this point, you know, you're choked out. You've called uncle. No, don't move that $40 billion. I believe you can. I will certainly sign off on the fact that you're able to.
Yeah, because what we found was we had to... So I was able to figure out you needed a VPN, you needed the right tokens and computers. So I called them up and convinced them to send me the computers.
Yeah, right. Huh. So, oh, what do I need to do that? Oh, this. Okay, can you send me one? Sure.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting. So
that's what was at the time called social engineering, and it's still sort of called that, but there's other versions of what it's called. Social engineering, is that's the right term there, right?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, social engineering is really just lying over the phone. Now the term has been so bastardized, they make it a circle and call it vishing for voice phishing instead of, phishing is a form of social engineering in its pure form. Now they went from social engineering to phishing. Then they had to rename social engineering proper to vishing because they have no memory or they're new to the profession. No, so,
well, because they try to create new names so they can keep selling things. Like there's now purple teaming, which is a combination of red teaming and blue teaming. And every year they have to come up with new stuff or else people won't keep buying it under the old names. But it's the same stuff, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's an expression, never attribute something to malice where ignorance and stupidity will do. Yeah. And this is a case where I think the marketers are just ignorant and stupid about the origin of what they're talking about.
There's that too, right? So people don't read, they don't look at the history, and anything that's not from the internet era sort of doesn't count.
Yeah, and it just was there. And then I wrote a paper about it. I had no clue. My company just had a policy that if you had a paper accepted at a professional conference, they'd have to send you. Never in Salt Lake City before. So I just wrote up a paper on how to take over a bank, and I sent that in. And then what happened was when I sent it in, all of a sudden, you know, it was called the seminal work in social engineering. And I joke, I had to look up what seminal meant and what social engineering meant. And they people started coming out of the woodwork to ask me to do more and more of this work. And I ended up doing a lot of it.
I love looking at my own career against timelines of other of my friends, because we didn't know each other back then. 1994 was the first couple of years into the Borderware firewall server days, right? It's how I got into all this. So I'm talking about imposter syndrome. I'm standing there up on stage running my mouth, hoping I'm not going to get caught out of my being wrong about something. Because out in the world in the Pentagon, there's people who really know. And at that same time, there's IRA in the Pentagon. And nobody in the Pentagon knows except kind of IRA, you know, and that's just the way it was in 1994. Yeah, you know, for everybody, you know, listening, right? You know, opportunity, we always assume that everything's kind of done already. But you'd be amazed at what a scaffolded world we live in. There's a lot of things are just developing.
Yeah, so the experience of happenstance, and IRA described this so well. You know, he's right. Like, you know, I'm just like walking down the street and all of a sudden it turned out I caught the Nazis, you know,
yes,
before. No.
It's amazing how things work out, right? Well, person after person after person in our community. You know, it's just the same right. All the time, right? And it's fantastic. I'll tell you, adopt an older cybersecurity person today. We should have a saying, right? You want to find an aunt, uncle, grandparent to adopt. You know, there are folks out here that will amaze you forever with the stories.
One of the things about this is it has changed. And right. One of the things that changed, so I used to go to a conference in downtown San Francisco, the Computer Security Institute or whatever. And, you know, I would submit a talk every year and I would get in without any real substantial difficulty. And I'd go down and give the talk. And then there were people that couldn't make it for one reason or another, their transportation didn't make it or whatever. And so they'd have these open sessions. And I'd talk to the organizer of the conference. The organizers would say, we have this session. Could you do something in that time slot? And I said, well, what was the topic? And they said, oh, here, you know, this is the topic. I said, sure, I can cover that.
Right.
So in most cases, because I'd already, you know, given a talk about it, I had a related slide. So I would just go in, you know, and almost no notice and go talk about it. And there's, oh, this was great. This was a great talk. And I ended up doing two or three of those every conference besides the one that I had signed up to do. Nowadays, you know, something like the RSA conference, I can't even get into it. Well, you've been successful at getting into it. It's one of those things where if you get one talk, you've done a whole bunch of things right. They also look at your history of talks and your previous talks. So they're not looking for new and interesting. What they're looking for is somebody that will get this rating on this form that we can have come back because they did it last year and people liked it.
I'm always saying to our peers, right, you know, that look, this is a sign of our success. It's no longer exclusive. You know, this is in fact something that the entire world, you and your instructor and you and your PhD paper came up with the concept in the word computer virus. Now, every living human being on Earth knows all about that, right? You know, so there's a lot of things that are fascinating, but there's a lot of things where a group will get around it and, you know, develop a core group and it'll stay that way forever. And it doesn't go much further. And then sometimes there are things that go to the entire planet. And along the way, those early folks like you and I and our age and in this industry are surrounded and maybe even drowned out. And it's not always a bad thing. Some of the downsides, you know, things aren't done as well as they could have been done, but they're done at scale. And they're set on a path where they're going to keep evolving regardless of what any one individual does.
The Wild West has given in to not necessarily better, but it has to scale. If you don't have scalable solutions, if you don't have, and that includes the conferences and the people. So no person can be irreplaceable anymore, ever.
Right.
Because you know eventually they're going to go away and we're going to still have all this stuff. So it's now become this fully corporatized environment. But the other aspect of it is a lot of it's just BS, right? Yeah. People are selling the same thing under a different name and it didn't work last time and it's not going to work this time. It's not that it doesn't work at all. It's like when somebody's going to invent a better one, but who cares? We can sell this one, right?
And lots of things happen, you know, and you have a proper system to be able to adopt these over time, things get better. Most of the things tried are probably stupid, but that's, yeah, right. That's all right. It's fine, right?
It gets frustrating to see ridiculous. The other frustrating thing is people that don't bother to study up on what they're doing.
So the downside of experience, right? You know, you get more and more often see people, and I can speak for myself anyways, I see in earlier versions of myself, ooh, I did that. I thought I understood things. Oh yeah, that was, you know, 10 years later. Oh yeah, no, I didn't.
That talks about the lack of an education system, right? Because if you're in biology and you get an education in biology, you know all this stuff about the history. You know how that worked. You know how it was put together. You know where it came from. You know what failed and so forth. And so you're not going to go redo stupid things that we thought were brilliant in the 1400s, but by the 1500s, we knew it just, you know, that's not how it worked. Yeah, in cybersecurity, we haven't done that from an educational standpoint. So no. We don't have that well-developed field.
I was going to say, you know, I'd like a world where lots of people are trying all sorts of crazy things without the experience behind. mind because that leads to all sorts of things. Yeah, but in cybersecurity is serious stuff because there's consequences. People's lives, people's fortunes, their quality of life and so forth come down to cybersecurity. And I'm willing to put up with a certain amount of BS if there's going to be more of it in total, more security in total, and a certain amount of imperfection if it's going to meet the mission. Let's keep the systems running. Let's keep people safe.
There's more at stake. There's the future of society, right?
And safe people.
What kind of society do you want to live in, right? Do you want to live in a surveillance society? Do you want to live in a society where people trust each other?
Right? Safe, right? Yeah, exactly.
Regardless of the path to it, I'm still just asking about the goal, right? So we don't have a well-defined goal or well-defined terms. And so trying to figure out how to achieve them, I think requires that you know what it is you're trying to achieve. Although maybe not. Maybe you just randomly do stuff and you come across something that's good and you use it and it's an evolutionary process, right? Random variation and selective survival.
Well, in the words of a great American philosopher, Forrest Gump, I think both, maybe both.
If there's anything I can do to help you out in the cybersecurity arena, please get in touch via the ALL.net website. If you're starting or trying to grow a company, please visit a2e.co for free assistance and advice. Next week on The Cyber Show, a new year brings new frauds. Kevin gets into child pornography. Hank resorts to extrajudicial means. Sean molds strawberries in Hawaii. Ira Black bags it with the KGB. And who knows what else? Only here on The Cyber Show on KMBY, 1240 AM, Monterey.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.